Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Colette Adkins, Reptile and Amphibian Senior Attorney. She's dedicated to protecting rare amphibians and reptiles across the country. She received her law degree from the University of Minnesota, where she also earned a master's degree in wildlife conservation. Before joining the center, Colette was in private practice, where her pro bono work focused on preservation of endangered species and their habitats. She also served as a law clerk to the Honorable John R. Tunheim in the U.S. District Court for the District of Minnesota. So, first off, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, we've heard that most people, or at least some people, have heard that there are big problems affecting amphibians, a worldwide amphibian die-off. And can you first talk about chytrid, and then at some point then talk about some of the other threats to reptiles and amphibians?
Sure. Well, you're right that amphibians and reptiles are some of the most imperiled taxa that we have on the planet. And we want to focus in on amphibians. You know, they face just a wide variety of threats, from habitat destruction, disease, climate change, collection, exploitation from the wild. You're definitely right that chytrid is one of the key threats. Now, chytrid, this is a fungal disease that's been causing mass die-offs and extinctions of amphibians just worldwide. We've got tropical forests that now are practically devoid of amphibians that used to be teeming with dozens of species. Scientists say that there's been a serious decline or extinction of more than 200 different species of amphibians worldwide. So this is, like I said, it's a fungus. It's a skin-eating fungus, and scientists still are trying to figure out the exact mechanism by which it hurts amphibians. But what we do know is that it's highly lethal to some amphibians, causing populations just to plummet and be extirpated. But then just as bad, some amphibians don't die from it, but they remain carriers, so that when those amphibians hop from one pond to another, they can spread the disease and then, of course, cause additional die-off to other amphibians that are susceptible to its effects. So I've got, you know, I can say a lot about chytrid. I've got a lot of examples of species across the country that have been impacted by the disease. You know, one that we worked on is the boreal toad. So in the southern Rockies, less than 1% of the historic range of the boreal toad is now occupied by these amphibians. So we've got 99% declines in the southern Rockies. Really only in Colorado does the boreal toad still exist in any kind of substantial number. And this is a species that now the Fish and Wildlife Service is considering for Endangered Species Act protection because of chytrid.
And how is that 1% in Colorado doing? Are they still plummeting, or is there some resistance?
No, they are really susceptible. There's a few populations left that just haven't been infected yet, and scientists are doing their very best to monitor those populations without spreading the disease to them. You know, the Center for Biological Diversity, we filed a petition to list the boreal toad in 2011, and then a year later, the Fish and Wildlife Service did examine our petition and found that federal endangered protection may be warranted, and although they didn't then take action to actually list the species, so we did sue the agency and then came to a settlement agreement. So in 2017, the agency will make a final decision as to whether toads in the southern Rockies and also in Utah, southern Idaho, and northeastern Nevada, whether they'll be listed under the Endangered Species Act, and their primary cause of decline is chytrid fungus.
I'm not really sure how, I mean, I understand politics, but I don't know how you can have a population that is 1% of its historic population and declining due to a disease that is has a very high mortality and it not be pretty much an automatic decision that this creature is endangered. That makes no sense to me.
Well, I do think that it will be listed. It's just a matter of when. And the Fish and Wildlife Service does have a tremendous backlog of species that deserve the protection of the Act and just haven't gotten it. Unfortunately, this is an agency that has really constrained its own ability to be an effective manager of endangered wildlife by capping its own funding each year for listing decisions. Of course, listing species is controversial. The boreal toad, for example, its listing is opposed by the timber industry because habitat destruction is another threat to the toad. So really, there's only so many species each year that get listings, and there's a long list of species waiting for protection. But it does look like the toad will get protected in 2017.
You know, I'm speaking of budget cuts, I'm an old enough activist that I actually remember when the Fish and Wildlife Service was actually much better than it was today, than it is today, and much more actually in the service of the wild. And I remember in 1988, George Bush the First, one of his promises on the campaign trail was that he was going to gut the Endangered Species Act, and it didn't. He wasn't able to do it. But it was a great lesson for me as a young activist to see how Republicans and Democrats work. That the Republicans would say this is a terrible thing and needs to be stopped, and then Clinton and the Democrats basically worked to. They said no, we're not going to do anything terrible to it, and then they just reduced the funding on fish and wildlife. And it's just I'm not asking you to comment unless you want to, but that's just a terrible problem we face on. Basically, it's good cop, bad cop, you know?
Right. Oh, it is terribly frustrating. And it's contrary to what the public wants. The Endangered Species Act and survey after survey has received broad support from the public. The public cares about wild things and wild places and doesn't want to be responsible for the extinction of species. And when, for example, you know, rivers are too polluted, that's driving amphibians and fish to extinction. Those rivers are too polluted to be, you know, for us to swim in or to use as drinking water. This is a sign that we're just not doing right by our environment, and I think the public recognizes that. Fortunately, my organization, the Center for Biological Diversity, entered into this really big settlement agreement with the Fish and Wildlife Service back in 2011. It covers 757 different species. And now over the next few years, and we've been doing this since 2011, the Fish and Wildlife Service each year is required to list a certain number of species. And they just are slowly getting at this backlog of species that deserve protection but don't have it. And so finally, we're getting to the point where it is maybe like the olden days where the Fish and Wildlife Service is just regularly churning out these listings and really doing a better job of making sure that we can prevent species extinction by getting them those life-saving protections of the Endangered Species Act.
Let's talk for a couple minutes about just some of the individual species besides the boreal toad, others. That you might want to just highlight for people who've been hammered by chytrid. Like, I mean, I know a couple famous ones. There's like the mouth brooder frog, or there's what, the golden frog of Costa Rica, I believe. So you don't have to use those, but like any, just a few that you want to, kind of like the AIDS quilt. I mean, commemorate these species, let people know about them, like have people fall in love with them.
Yeah, well, one amphibian that I really love that's unfortunately threatened by chytrid is the eastern hellbender. Now, for one, this animal has this amazing name, hellbender. But two, it is the North America's largest salamander. It can grow up to 2 feet long, but it's solely aquatic. It's another common name for it is old lasagna side because it's got this wavy patterns on the sides of its body that kind of looks like lasagna, and it's got this adaptation so that it has more surface area to absorb oxygen from the water. It's got this long keeled tail that helps it swim through fast currents, and this flattened body so that it can cling to the bottom of these fast-moving water waves. It used to be found throughout the eastern United States, but its populations are declining, largely due to pollution of its waterways, damming, habitat destruction that causes, you know, like if you do timber harvest or intensive grazing near these waterways, and you get this erosion into the waterways. But then chytrid is also a threat. Just in January of this year, there was a new study that showed that chytrid now is impacting hellbenders in North Carolina. And it just seems like every few months another state comes out and says they've documented chytrid in hellbenders. And here in North Carolina, scientists found that more than 25% of the hellbenders that they sampled were infected with the disease. So this really cool animal. Well, the center petitioned to list it back in 2010, and the Fish and Wildlife Service again found that it may be warranted for listing just a year later. And then when they didn't act, we did sue the agency, and now they've committed through settlement to make a listing decision in 2018. So this is an example of another amphibian that's impacted not just by chytrid, but other threats as well. And it's just causing these rapid declines. Yeah, I really want to live in a world that is rich with all the different types of life. You know, even these ones that are secretive, like the hellbender, that you'd just be really lucky to see. I just feel better living in a world where I know these amazing creatures exist.
You know, sometimes people complain that when I'm writing about the horrible things that this culture is doing, sometimes some people complain, well, gosh, Derek, you never say what you're for. And that has always struck me as just absurd, because from the beginning of my career, I've been very clear that what I want is to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before, and more migratory songbirds, and more rough-skinned newts, and more tree frogs and red-legged frogs and hellbenders, for that matter. It's pretty straightforward. So let's talk a little bit more about the mechanics, not specifically the mechanics, but so is chytrid, and I actually don't know the answer to this, is chytrid, when it hits a pond, let's say a pond that has no chytrid, and then there's boreal toads in this pond, and then chytrid is introduced to this pond, however it's introduced, can we expect a 90% mortality, 99% mortality, 100%, 50%, what would be a typical, and I know it's going to vary by species, but for a species who is susceptible to it, what would be the mortality rate over what time period?
Well, I think it's very species dependent, and I think scientists are actually still just trying to work that exact question out, and I think it really does vary depending on the susceptibility of the species, but also the conditions in the environment. One thing that scientists are discovering now is that there's synergistic effects between chytrid and certain environmental factors. So, for example, if a pond also has toxic runoff from agricultural areas, or even gets pesticides through drift from agricultural areas, that having pesticides will reduce the immunity of amphibians and make them more susceptible to the chytrid. And really any factor that would reduce immunity would increase the susceptibility to chytrid. So even an amphibian like the boreal toad, for example, that might be stressed because its habitat has been degraded through timber harvest or grazing, that animal then would be more likely to actually die from chytrid. I think the boreal toad is one of the examples of where we've seen, you know, chytrid get introduced to a pond and then have quite rapid declines. You know, really some ponds being fully extirpated of the toads, you know, rapidly within even a year of the infection. With the hellbender, for example, it appears to have much slower impacts, with many of the animals being able to live with the disease. You know, another area where Kittredge's been taking its toll is in the Sierra Nevada, California. We've got mountain yellow-legged frogs there that are both being considered for state protection, and some of those populations do have federal Endangered Species Act protection. And that's with the Sierra Nevada mountain yellow-legged frog. We've got 75% of the populations that have disappeared, largely due to Kittredge, but also other factors like introduction of non-native fish, trout stocking, for example, will eat up the Sierra Nevada yellow-legged frog tadpoles. But scientists have specifically studied these yellow-legged frogs and found that pesticides drifting from California's Central Valley have made the threat of Kittredge much worse by making these animals have lower immunity and thus be more susceptible to the disease.
Which should not be a surprise to anybody. I mean, if your immune system is weakened, obviously there are other opportunistic pathogens who, I mean, this doesn't matter whether you're a frog or a human being or a seagull. You know, if you have a weakened immune system, you're going to be more susceptible to, and if for various reasons your whole endocrine system is messed up and mm-hmm. your whole immune system is messed up, of course you're going to be more susceptible to opportunistic diseases. That's the whole AIDS thing, you know, that they don't actually die of mm-hmm. of HIV itself. They die of one of the various opportunistic diseases.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, scientists have been looking at how climate change is interacting with Kittredge. And there's been several different studies that actually have come up with competing answers there, and they just really had a hard time figuring out what the, you know, they had suspected that there was, that climate change would worsen the effects of Kittredge, but they just couldn't figure out why. And just last year, a scientist appears to have figured it out and found out that some amphibians will secrete have a skin secretion that actually has antifungal properties so that it can better resist Kittredge, but that under a heat stress, the amphibian can't produce this secretion and thus even more susceptible to Kittredge. And what this, you know, the take home for me on that is that, boy, the world, you know, our natural world is just such a complex place that we just know so little about. And that when we do something like aid in the spread of a disease like Kittredge, we don't know all the different ways that we're going to be, you know, messing up our wild places. But we sure do it, right? And it sure would be great if we could take steps to prevent diseases like this. And I should mention, you know, so that Kittredge is actually a group of funguses, and the one we've been talking about so far is BV. That's a fungus that's already in the United States. But there's another Kittredge fungus that was first discovered back in fall of 2013. People are calling that B-Sal for short, and that's a fungus, a type of Kittredge that actually hasn't reached the United States yet. And we're hoping that we can actually prevent this disease from coming into the United States. It's been causing rapid and steep mortality of salamanders in the Netherlands. We've got populations there that just within, you know, a year or two after its discovery have already been completely wiped out, populations on average down to 4% of what they were before being exposed to the fungus. And we're trying to convince the Fish and Wildlife Service to suspend imports of salamanders into the United States until they can have been certified free of the fungus. So what we're hoping for is that the Fish and Wildlife Service would list Kittredge under the, would list salamanders as injurious wildlife under the Lacey Act, and that would would prohibit the importation of these salamanders and the interstate commerce in the salamanders. So we just really aren't bringing these infected salamanders into our country or across state borders.
This is this whole notion of importation and of, you mentioned the yellow-legged frog, the yellow-legged frogs getting harmed by fish, and I want to come back to that in a minute. But can we talk about where chytrid came from and how it expanded across the world in the first place?
You know, I am not sure about the origin of
chytrid.
Oh,
I can tell you. I can tell you, actually.
Yeah, please.
Okay, it originally was, what's the word when you have a disease that has a long-term relationship with an animal, where it actually doesn't end up not killing the animal, but just lives with it and might harm it a little bit, but it's no big deal. So that's its relationship with the African horned frog, I believe. There's a frog in Africa who lived with chytrid forever, and it's all fine. And this frog, unfortunately, is used for the aquarium trade and also has been used in vivisection for medical experiments. And so they transported this frog all over the world, and then when people got sick of their frogs in their aquariums, they would dump them out. Or when the vivisectors were done with the experiments with the frogs, they would dump the water out. And so they spread this all over the world through the pet industry and through vivisection. And, you know, I was a beekeeper in my 20s, a commercial beekeeper, and that was back when the whole Africanized, you know, killer bee thing started to get known. And it just struck me, even though I wasn't really an activist at that point, it just struck me as incredibly stupid that if you're going to do – the reason that the Africanized bees ended up in the Americas is because they were doing an experiment with them, trying to breed them with European bees to get the best traits of both or something. And they did these experiments in South America. And it's like, dude, if you're going to do something that is so possibly destructive and could have an error, do it in Africa where nothing's going to – do it in Africa where the Africanized bees are from.
Oof.
And it's the same with this, that the transport – this chytrid thing is an entirely global trade, whether it's pet or hospital, global trade-driven incident. And that takes me, and then I'm gonna rant for another 30 seconds, and then I'll shut up and you can talk. And that one of the things – I live in California. One of the things that just pisses me off about the yellow-legged frog is that California Fish and Game continues to stock alpine – lakes with non-native fish, even though these non-native fish have been shown time and again to kill native frogs and also kill endangered native trout, like the California golden trout. And it's just, it strikes me as completely insane to intentionally introduce an exotic species that is hurting an endangered native. I can hear my voice getting thin and reedy because this pisses me off so much. Okay, so I'm done with that. So do you want to just take off anywhere you want to go with any of that?
Sure. Well, you know, the story of how BD spread to the United States is just so similar to how BSAL, this one that's specific to salamanders, is starting now to be spread worldwide. But, you know, we're so lucky that it hasn't yet reached the United States. So just like you described with the African toad, so what we've got here with BSAL is that in Asia, the BSAL, that fungus, has been there for millions of years, and the native amphibians in Asia have co-evolved with that fungus, adapting and gaining a resistance to it. But then because of globalization, we've got amphibians from Asia now being traded globally as pets. And that brings the pathogen into contact with salamanders that haven't yet developed a resistance to it. And that's what we've seen in the Netherlands, where fire salamanders have been almost wiped out in just a few years. And there was a study published just a few months ago in late fall of 2014 that showed that this new deadly salamander fungus is in the pet trade. And really, and the logical outcome of the study is that we really need governmental agencies to find a way to make sure that it doesn't get imported into the United States, because just like you described with amphibians infected with BD, we fear that people will import these infected salamanders. They'll keep them as pets, but then they'll get released into the environment, and then the fungus will spread into the environment. And what's particularly sad about these funguses is that they can completely wipe out the population, but the fungus still remains in the environment. So you can't even reintroduce the population. So let's say you take the last few boreal toads from a pond or something and treat them of the disease in captivity. That pond is forever marred. You can never release the toads back into that area because the environment has been forever altered. Well, maybe someday we'll come up with a way to eliminate the fungus from the environment, but that's not something within our technical capacity now. And so it really makes sense to prevent the spread of this disease. And we've got an action alert right now up on our webpage at biologicaldiversity.org where people can take action to save the salamander. Just kind of click and send a letter to the Fish and Wildlife Service asking them to suspend salamander imports. Congress, there's a couple bills before Congress too. There's one called the Wildlife Disease Emergency Act, and that's one that would give the Secretary of the Interior the power to declare wildlife disease emergencies. It would set aside funds for rapid response and facilitate cooperation between agencies. There's another one called the Invasive Fish and Wildlife Prevention Act, and that would authorize the Fish and Wildlife Service to promulgate regulations that could help prevent invasions. So there are some tools that the government could take to help curb the spread of these diseases. And in the meantime, we're really hoping that the pet industry will impose some voluntary measures. I mean, they don't want to import pets that are infected with this disease either, because it would, rapidly spread in their captive situations as well. So we're hoping that the pet industry will now start voluntarily testing their imported salamanders. There really is a very simple DNA-based test that will detect the disease. And then there's a couple different ways that the animals can be treated in captivity, antifungal baths, and even some heat treatments that can kill the disease. But that's in captivity. Once it's out in the wild, there's really nothing to be done.
So is there... I've been following chytrid. How long has chytrid been? How long have we known that chytrid has been killing frogs around the world? Is it 10 years now? 15 years? 10 years? I don't know how long.
Yeah, I don't know exactly either, but yeah, I would say probably about 15 years.
So, is there any? This is something that I've been sort of praying for, but I haven't known this. Is there any indication that anybody anywhere is developing a natural resistance to it, except for the original carriers from a long time ago? Is there any indication that anyone who's gotten hammered, like if there was a 90% reduction in the frogs in some pond or salamanders in some pond, and the ones who survived passed on resistance to their descendants, is there any indication that that's happening anywhere?
I haven't seen any studies that have remarked on that. It does seem like logically what would happen under, sort of our basic principles of evolution. However, chytrid isn't the only thing that's impacting these populations.
Right.
So once you've got, let's again take the boreal toad, for example, maybe you've reduced that population in a set of ponds down to 5%, and those 5% are immune to the disease. then you've got just a very small population that's now being subjected to many other threats. And just itself, being a very small population in itself is a huge threat to the species. You've got such small genetic variability there that even though it might be less susceptible to Kitchard, that there could be other problems with, you know, basically the same sort of concepts of inbreeding. You know, once you've got such a small set of genetic variation, you can be more susceptible to pesticides or, you know, global warming or you know, predation or whatever else.
Well, and in addition, I mean, frankly, frogs and salamanders and all, a lot of those little itty-bitty beings, they can have boom and bust cycles anyway because, you know, the frogs in the pond here, there can be just tens of thousands of tadpoles, and I fully recognize that, you know, almost all those are going to die before they even metamorphose into adults because their primary ecological job is to be food for somebody else.
Right.
And so that makes it, you know, if you reduce the population down to from 1,000 frogs, it actually doesn't matter. If there's 1,000 frogs, it doesn't matter if 45 of them get eaten by herons or somebody. But if there's only 50 frogs and 45 of them get eaten, then obviously it's done.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, one of the things that's really sad to me is that the United States, we are a global hotspot of salamander biodiversity. One of the most, you know, if you look across the entire world, the Pacific Northwest, the southeastern United States, these are areas that have more salamanders than really any other place in the world. We've got nearly 200 species of salamanders in the United States. But if BSAL gets in here, we could just rapidly lose these animals in the wild. And not just the rare ones, you know, but even the common ones that really are just, you know, a part of so many, even kids' lives, you know, just interacting with bees in their backyard, wetlands and forests, like the eastern red-spotted newt or the rough-skinned newt in the Pacific Northwest. That recent study that was looking at the impacts of BSAL found 100% mortality of both eastern newts and rough-skinned newts in lab tests. So it's just vital that we can keep this out of the wild.
And it's like you said about there being a lot of other threats, which I want to talk about in just a second. But rough-skinned newts, I've lived where I live now for 15 years, and I've gone from seeing, if I go out and sit by the pond at the right time of year, I could easily see, oh gosh, 8 or 10 newts come up for air in the pond.
Mm-hmm.
And now if I sit out there for the same amount of time, I might see 1 or 2. And when I've talked to old timers who've been here for, you know, 40, 50 years, back in the 60s and 70s, they would routinely see 100 newts. You know, they were just, it'd be like nowadays seeing a mosquito, you know, it's like, oh, you know, I saw a whole ton of newts today, big deal. And so there's even without the chytrid, the rough-skinned newt populations here have been collapsing. And I remember when I was a kid, you know, to my shame and horror, I had an aquarium, and I remember being at the fish stores and seeing rough-skinned newts. I mean, they were so common that they were just routinely sold for like $2 or something. And
right.
Now they're much more. I mean, they're even somebody as common as a rough-skinned newt is getting hammered. That's my whole point.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and yet these animals, they still are in the pet trade, and that's what's, you know, what is scary about it, because, you know, if you've got an animal that's highly susceptible to disease that's still being traded in a pet trade that already has been documented to be infected with this fungus. So, I just really hope we don't have another situation here like we do with BD,
so
where it just gets here and starts causing these extirpations.
So tell me about other threats to amphibians, and also, you know, we mentioned just in your introduction, we mentioned reptiles, and I don't want to give them short shrift. All the, you know, all the geckos are saying hello, hello. What about us?
Right.
So, can you talk about other threats to amphibians? Oh, wait, before that. Let's talk about specifically pesticides, and then let's talk about other threats to amphibians and reptiles. So give me your best give listeners your best your best spiel, your best anti-pesticide amphibian slash reptile spiel.
Right. Well, I spend a lot of my work days on pesticides. That's something I feel so strongly about, both for human health reasons, but also the health of wildlife populations. We've got, I've probably got 4 or 5 different cases right now where we're trying to get governmental agencies to do a better job regulating pesticides. You know, the EPA, that's the governmental agency that's charged with registering pesticides, they just routinely register for use pesticides that are known to be toxic to wildlife and to humans. So what we're doing here is trying to get the government to analyze the impacts of endangered species and restrict the use of pesticides in the most sensitive habitats. Here's an example, atrazine. This is one of the most commonly detected contaminants in waterways across the United States. It's an herbicide that's used corn, soybeans, contaminating waterways, you know, in the Midwest, across the country. And yet scientists have found that atrazine can cause male frogs to turn into female frogs, basically castrating male frogs at levels that the EPA has found to be safe to be in drinking water. So we've got just really stark examples of how pesticides are fundamentally altering nature, and it's been their science indicates that atrazine causes certain, it's endocrine disruptor, certain reproductive diseases as well, and yet it's still registered for use with very few restrictions. So pesticides, other toxins too, really are a primary threat to amphibians. And in terms of reptiles, you know, they face a lot of the same threats that amphibians face. So definitely habitat destruction. I would say amphibians are a little bit more susceptible to pesticides than reptiles because amphibians do have the permeable skins and they spend more of their time in waterways that are often polluted with pesticides. But toxins and pesticides certainly are a threat to reptiles as well. Both amphibians and reptiles are subjected to exploitation by humans for the pet trade. And reptiles, especially the snakes, get killed just out of fear. Big snakes get killed for meat and for their skins. There are these horrible events called rattlesnake roundups where people hunt these snakes and compete in contests. You know, they get prizes for the heaviest snake and the longest snake, and then those snakes are killed for skin or meats at the end of these contests. The eastern diamondback rattlesnake, we've petitioned to get it protected under the Endangered Species Act, and the Fish and Wildlife Service has found that protection may be warranted under the act, and yet in the Southeast, there's still a handful of these roundups that every year incentivize the killing of these snakes. The turtle trade is another threat, another example of where humans are just over-exploiting wildlife. Turtles are taken out of the wild for pets and for meat, and scientists have been doing studies, particularly on snapping turtles, and have been found that really there's no sustainable level of harvest for turtles. You take a few large adults out of a population, and it begins to decline, slowly the population gets extirpated because you just require these large, mature females to keep reducing and keep the population stable.
And when I was a kid, I grew up in Colorado on the Front Range, and to the east, I knew some people from Kansas, and I know that at that point, box turtles were, it's kind of like I was saying about the newts, at that point, you could go out in the plains, and if it was the right time of year and everything, you would be surprised not to see a box turtle. And so I have been, I was, it's just heartbreaking to me how creatures who are common like that, my understanding is that box turtles are now rare enough to at least qualify for endangered species protection.
Well, I've been starting to do some work on box turtles. One thing that we're seeing with box turtles again is disease, and we've in the Northeast in particular, there's a lot of small communities that will do these turtle races, and I like the idea of little kids slumping around and finding turtles and bringing them together and doing what seems like a fairly harmless little race at their local community festival. The problem is that when they bring these turtles together, they get exposed to disease because they're exposed to each other, and then the kids go and release them back out into the wild, and this disease spreads. So, also there's a threat of spreading the disease to humans. So turtles are a huge carrier of salmonella, which has even killed young children. But there's an infectious disease called rhinovirus that is killing eastern box turtles. We targeted a turtle race in Maryland that's done over the 4th of July holiday because that rhinovirus had been discovered in the area. So we definitely didn't want people bringing these box turtles into close proximity to each other where the disease could be spread, and then people keep them as pets and then move and then release them again. And this is really just another example of how this new changed world we live in now, where travel is more common, trade is more common, we can just be spreading diseases in ways that really weren't possible, several decades ago.
So, we have about 5 or 6 minutes left, and I have a few questions. And one of them is, so what you presented a lot of really important information here, and what would you want people who hear this interview to do? Well, first, the people who hear this interview, if you could have them take away one thing that they know in their heart from this interview, what would that be? And then the next question is be, what do you want them to do? But what do you want them to learn from this interview? What's your take-home point?
Right. Well, I think an important take-home message is that humans are having an irreversible impact on our environment. And the choices that we make do have implications for the health of our planet. So something as small as will the government suspend the trade in salamanders? I mean, that's not a huge, huge industry important for national defense or something. This is the salamander pet trade, which really shouldn't have that strong of a lobby, and yet somehow the government seems resistant to take this small step. So I think the idea that really humans do have a big impact on the environment, and yet there are things that can be done about it if we have the willpower to make it happen. And then I guess in terms of taking action, that's exactly what I'd like to see people do, is to encourage their representatives, encourage the Fish and Wildlife Service on whatever, here on this issue, if this is something that you're passionate about, tell the Fish and Wildlife Service to suspend salamander imports. Tell your congressional representatives that you support legislation that would give the Fish and Wildlife Service more authority to respond to wildlife diseases. But whatever issue it is that you feel strongly about, take action. I really think of that as our moral duty, the price that we should pay for the impacts that we just can't control just because we live on this planet. Do your part to try to make the world a better place.
And what about, in addition to all that, which I completely agree with, in addition to all that, are there things? I mean, it seems to me that one of the central things that everybody needs is a home. And it seems to me that habitat protection of especially large areas is incredibly important. So are there things people can do also? I mean, what do you think? I mean, I think this is a pretty obvious question and answer, but so what about also protecting habitat for them in various places? Protecting habitat for the box turtle or for the boreal toad, and just working very hard to give them the area to live.
That's absolutely right. And even in people's own yards, I know that sometimes, people sort of feel like, oh, this is just a problem for the government, and there really isn't anything that I can do as an individual. But boy, take pesticides, for example. That is something where this is a consumer-driven threat. Support the organic movement, support local and sustainable farming practices in your own yard. Don't use pesticides on your lawn or your garden. Toads, for example, they can do well in just backyard habitats. And, I've got a little creek that runs by my backyard, and, we don't use anything on our lawns. And I just love the fact that I know my kids can go swamping around in that creek and find toads and frogs and have this little bit of experience with a little bit of wild that's left in our suburban neighborhood, and feel just a little bit inspired to keep these animals around, and so they can play their important role in our ecosystems.
And I before we started talking on the tape, but when we were just chatting beforehand, I mentioned Saprolegnia and how that's another mold that is hammering some creatures. And one of the things I've done, because Saprolegnia weakens egg, I'm sorry, Saprolegnia is everywhere. It eats weak egg sacs, and the egg sacs, many of them are weakened because of the weakening of the ozone layer allows UVB to go through. So one of the things I've done, frankly, is every once a week in the spring, I go out and I collect some of the tree frog egg sacs from the pond here, and then I bring them inside where the UVB can't get to them, and then as soon as they hatch, I release them back into the pond. And not everybody has that opportunity to do that, but I saw them collapsing. The point is, here's my big thing, is for the thing that frustrates me almost as much as the evil people who are killing everything is that most of us are just sitting on our butts. And there is something that somebody can do, and that can be on the largest national scale. It can be getting a law degree and doing what you're doing, or it can be actually trying to protect this particular egg sac. It's like these, I don't know if this is actually going to help on the larger scale, but all I know is that there are frogs in the pond who wouldn't be there if it weren't for that. It's like whatever we do. So I have one last question, which is, if they made you the queen of all things reptile and amphibian, and okay, the rule is you can't get rid of global trade and you can't get rid of capitalism, even though as much as we would probably like to do both of those. But so what sort of policy things would you institute? I'm presuming that you would stop the international trade in amphibians. What else would you do if you were the queen of all things chytrid and all things reptile and amphibian?
Yeah, I definitely would take action on pesticides. I think it would be the right thing to do for amphibians, reptiles, and also be the right thing for human health. I would just really severely restrict the use of pesticides. Really making them mandatory buffers between agricultural fields and waterways, making sure that they're not used in sensitive wildlife habitats, making sure that we use the safest alternatives available. I would take action to reduce impacts from pesticides.
Okay. Anything else you want to say?
Oh, I just really want to thank you for having me on the program, and thank your listeners for their interest and for all that they do to help wild things in wild places.
Well, thank you, and thank you so much for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Colette Atkins. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.